doing his best to hold his plumbing in, but it was a battle he was losing. One loop of intestines, shiny and bruise-colored, already hung out, resting against his left side like some awful watch chain. Guy feinted at me with his knife. I countered by shoving the mop bucket at him, and he drew back. I pulled it to me again and stood there with my hands wrapped around the wooden mop handle, ready to shove the bucket at him if he moved. Behind Guy, the cook had managed to get all the way up. Slowly, like an invalid in early recovery from a serious operation, he started working his way down the aisle toward Gimple the Fool. I wished him well. "Undo those bolts," I said to Diane. "What?" "The bolts on the door. Undo them." "I can't move," she said. She was crying so hard I could barely understand her. "You're crushing me." I moved forward a little to give her room. Guy bared his teeth at me, mock jabbed with the knife, then pulled it back, grinning his nervous, snarling little grin as I rolled the bucket at him again on its squeaky casters. "Bug-infested stinkpot," he said. He sounded like a man discussing the Mets' chances in the forthcoming campaign. "Let's see you play your radio this loud now, stinkpot. It gives you a change in your thinking, doesn't it? Boink!" He jabbed. I rolled. But this time, he didn't pull back as far, and I realized he was nerving himself up. He meant to go for it, and soon. I could feel Diane's breasts brush against my back as she gasped for breath. I'd given her room, but she hadn't turned around to work the bolts. She was just standing there. "Open the door," I told her, speaking out of the side of my mouth like a prison con. "Pull the goddamn bolts, Diane." "I can't," she sobbed. "I can't. I don't have any strength in my hands. Make him stop, Stephen. Don't stand there talking with him. Make him stop." She was driving me insane. I really thought she was. "You turn around and pull those bolts, Diane, or I'll just stand aside and let..." "Yee!" he screamed and charged, waving and stabbing with his knife. I slammed the mop bucket forward with all the force I could muster and swept his legs out from under him. He howled and brought the knife down in a long, desperate stroke. Any closer and it would have torn off the tip of my nose. Then he landed spraddled awkwardly on widespread knees, with his face just above the mop-squeezing gadget hung on the side of the bucket. Perfect. I drove the mop head into the nape of his neck. The strings draggled down over the shoulders of his black jacket like a witch wig. His face slammed into the squeegee. I bent, grabbed the handle with my free hand, and clamped it shut. Guy shrieked with pain, the sound muffled by the mop. "Pull those bolts," I screamed at Diane. "Pull those bolts, you useless bitch! Pull!" Thud. Something hard and pointed slammed into my left buttock. I staggered forward with a yell, more surprise than pain, I think, although it did hurt. I went to one knee and lost my hold on the squeegee handle. Guy pulled back, slipping out from under the stringy head of the mop at the same time, breathing so loudly he sounded almost as if he were barking. It hadn't slowed him down much, though. He lashed out at me with the knife as soon as he was clear of the bucket. I pulled back, feeling the breeze as the blade cut the air beside my cheek. It was only as I scrambled up that I realized what had happened, what she had done. I snatched a quick glance over my shoulder at her. She stared back defiantly, her back pressed against the door. A crazy thought came to me. She wanted me to get killed, had perhaps even planned it, the whole thing. Found herself a crazy maitre d' and... Her eyes widened. "Look out!" I turned back just in time to see him lunging at me. The sides of his face were bright red, except for the big white spots made by the drain holes in the squeegee. I rammed the mop head at him, aiming for the throat and getting his chest instead. I stopped his charge and actually knocked him backward a step. What happened then was only luck. He slipped in water from the overturned bucket and went down hard, slamming his head on the tiles. Not thinking and just vaguely aware that I was screaming, I snatched up the skillet of mushrooms from the stove and brought it down on his upturned face as hard as I could. There was a muffled thump, followed by a horrible but mercifully brief hissing sound as the skin of his cheeks and forehead boiled. I turned, shoved Diane aside, and drew the bolts holding the door shut. I opened the door and sunlight hit me like a hammer, and the smell of the air. I can't remember air ever smelling better, not even when I was a kid, and it was the first day of summer vacation. I grabbed Diane's arm and pulled her out into a narrow alley lined with padlocked trash bins. At the far end of this narrow stone slit, like a vision of heaven, was 53rd Street, with traffic going heedlessly back and forth. I looked over my shoulder and through the open kitchen door. Guy lay on his back with carbonized mushrooms circling his head like an existential diadem. The skillet had slid off to one side, revealing a face that was red and swelling with blisters. One of his eyes was open, but it looked unseeingly up at the fluorescent lights. Behind him, the kitchen was empty. There was a pool of blood on the floor and bloody handprints on the white enamel front of the walk-in fridge, but both the chef and Gimple the Fool were gone. I slammed the door shut and pointed down the alley. "Go on." She didn't move, only looked at me. I shoved her lightly on her left shoulder. "Go!" She raised a hand like a traffic cop, shook her head, then pointed a finger at me. "Don't you touch me." "What'll you do, sick your lawyer on me? I think he's dead, sweetheart." "Don't you patronize me like that. Don't you dare, and don't you touch me, Stephen. I'm warning you." The kitchen door burst open. Moving, not thinking, but just moving, I slammed it shut again. I leaned my back against it and braced my feet. "Do you want to stand here and discuss it?" I asked her. "He's still pretty lively by the sound." He hit the door again. I rocked with it, then slammed it shut. I waited for him to try again, but he didn't. Diane gave me a long look, glary and uncertain, and then started walking up the alleyway with her head down and her hair hanging at the sides of her neck. I stood with my back against the door until she got about 3/4 of the way to the street, then stood away from it, watching it warily. No one came out, but I decided that wasn't going to guarantee any peace of mind. I dragged one of the trash bins in front of the door, then set off after Diane, jogging. When I got to the mouth of the alley, she wasn't there anymore. I looked right toward Madison and didn't see her. I looked left, and there she was, wandering slowly across 53rd on a diagonal, her head still down and her hair still hanging like curtains at the sides of her face. No one paid any attention to her. The people in front of the Gotham Cafe were gawking through the plate glass windows like people in front of the New England Aquarium shark tank at feeding time. Sirens were approaching, a lot of them. I went across the street, reached for her shoulder, thought better of it. I settled for calling her name instead. She turned around, her eyes dulled with horror and shock. The front of her dress had turned into a grisly purple bib. She stank of blood and spent adrenaline. "Leave me alone," she said. "I never want to see you again, Stephen." "You kicked my ass in there," I said. "You kicked my ass and almost got me killed. Both of us. I can't believe you, Diane." "I wanted to kick your ass for the last 14 months," she said. "When it comes to fulfilling our dreams, we can't always pick our times, can we?" I slapped her across the face. I didn't think about it, I just did it, and few things in my adult life have given me so much pleasure. I'm ashamed of that, but I've come too far in this story to tell a lie, even one of omission. Her head rocked back, her eyes widened in shock and pain, losing that dull, traumatized look. "You bastard!" she cried, her hand going to her cheek. Now tears were brimming in her eyes. "Oh, you bastard!" "I saved your life," I said. "Don't you realize that? Doesn't that get through? I saved your fucking life." "You son of a bitch," she whispered. "You controlling, judgmental, small-minded, conceited, complacent son of a bitch. I hate you." "Did you even hear me? If it wasn't for the conceited, small-minded son of a bitch, you'd be dead now. If it wasn't for you, I wouldn't have been there in the first place," she said, as the first 3 police cars came screaming down 53rd Street and pulled up in front of the Gotham Cafe. Cops poured out of them like clowns in a circus act. "If you ever touch me again, I'll scratch your eyes out, Steve," she said. "Stay away from me." I had to put my hands in my armpits. They wanted to kill her, to reach out and wrap themselves around her neck and just kill her. She walked 7 or 8 steps, then turned back to me. She was smiling. It was a terrible smile, more awful than any expression I had seen on the face of Guy, the demon waiter. "I had lovers," she said, smiling her terrible smile. She was lying. The lie was all over her face, but that didn't make the lie hurt any less. She wished it was true. That was all over her face, too. "Three of them over the last year or so. You weren't any good at it, so I found men who were." She turned and walked down the street, like a woman who is 65 instead of 27. I stood and watched her. Just before she reached the corner, I shouted it again. It was the one thing I couldn't get past. It was stuck in my throat like a chicken bone. "I saved your life! Your goddamn life!" She paused at the corner and turned back to me. The terrible smile was still on her face. "No," she said, "you didn't." Then she went on around the corner. I haven't seen her since, although I suppose I will. I'll see her in court, as the saying goes. I found a market on the next block and bought a package of Marlboros. When I got back to the corner of Madison and 53rd, 53rd had been blocked off with those blue sawhorses the cops used to protect crime scenes and parade routes. I could see the restaurant, though. I could see it just fine. I sat down on the curb, lit a cigarette, and observed developments. Half a dozen rescue vehicles arrived, a scream of ambulances, I guess you could say. The chef went into the first one, unconscious but apparently still alive. His brief appearance before his fans on 53rd Street was followed by a body bag on a stretcher, Humboldt. Next came Guy, strapped tightly to a stretcher and staring wildly around as he was loaded into the back of an ambulance. I thought that for just a moment his eyes met mine, but that was probably just my imagination. As Guy's ambulance pulled away, rolling through a hole in the sawhorse barricade provided by two uniformed cops, I tossed the cigarette I'd been smoking in the gutter. I hadn't gone through this day just to start killing myself with tobacco again, I decided. I looked after the departing ambulance and tried to imagine the man inside it living wherever maitre d's live. Queens or Brooklyn or maybe even Rye or Mamaroneck. I tried to imagine what his own dining room might look like, what pictures might be on the walls. I couldn't do that, but I found I could imagine his bedroom with relative ease, although not whether he shared it with a woman. I could see him lying awake, but perfectly still, looking up at the ceiling in the small hours, while the moon hung in the black firmament like the half-lidded eye of a corpse. I could imagine him lying there and listening to the neighbor's dog bark steadily and monotonously, going on and on until the sound was like a silver nail driving into his brain. I imagined him lying not far from a closet filled with tuxedos and plastic dry-cleaning bags. I could see them hanging there in the dark like executed felons. I wondered if he did have a wife. If so, had he killed her before coming to work? I thought of the blob on his shirt and decided it was a possibility. I also wondered about the neighbor's dog, the one that wouldn't shut up, and the neighbor's family. But mostly it was Guy I thought about, lying sleepless through all the same nights I had lain sleepless, listening to the dog next door or down the street as I had listened to sirens and the rumble of trucks heading downtown. I thought of him lying there and looking up at the shadows the moon had tacked to the ceiling. Thought of that cry, "Yee!" building up in his head like gas in a closed room. "Yee!" I said, just to see how it sounded. I dropped the package of Marlboros into the gutter and began stamping it methodically as I sat there on the curb. "Yee! Yee! Eee!" One of the cops standing by the sawhorses looked over at me. "Hey, buddy, want to stop being a pain in the butt?" he called over. "We got us a situation here." "Of course you do," I thought. "Don't we all?" I didn't say anything, though. I stopped stamping. The cigarette pack was pretty well flattened by then anyway, and stopped making the noise. I could still hear it in my head, though, and why not? It makes as much sense as anything else. "Eee! Eee! Eee!" 1408. 1. Mike Enslin was still in the revolving door when he saw Olin, the manager of the Hotel Dolphin, sitting in one of the overstuffed lobby chairs. Mike's heart sank. Maybe should have brought the lawyer along again after all, he thought. Well, too late now. And even if Olin decided to throw up another roadblock or two between Mike and room 1408, that wasn't all bad. There were compensations. Olin was crossing the room with one pudgy hand held out as Mike left the revolving door. The Dolphin was on 61st Street, around the corner from 5th Avenue, small but smart. A man and woman dressed in evening clothes passed Mike as he reached for Olin's hand, switching his small overnight case to his left hand in order to do it. The woman was blonde, dressed in black, of course, and the light, flowery smell of her perfume seemed to summarize New York. On the mezzanine level, someone was playing Night and Day in the bar, as if to underline the summary. Mr. Enslin, good evening. Mr. Olin, is there a problem? Olin looked pained. For a moment, he glanced around the small, smart lobby as if for help. At the concierge stand, a man was discussing theater tickets with his wife, while the concierge himself watched them with a small, patient smile. At the front desk, a man with the rumpled look one only got after long hours in business class was discussing his reservation with a woman in a smart black suit that could itself have doubled for evening wear. It was business as usual at the Hotel Dolphin. There was help for everyone except poor Mr. Olin, who had fallen into the writer's clutches. Mr. Olin, Mike repeated. Mr. Enslin, could I speak to you for a moment in my office? Well, and why not? It would help the section on room 1408 add to the ominous tone the readers of his book seemed to crave, and that wasn't all. Mike Enslin hadn't been sure until now, in spite of all the backing and filling. Now he was. Olin was really afraid of room 1408 and of what might happen to Mike there tonight. Of course, Mr. Olin. Olin, the good host, reached for Mike's bag. Allow me. I'm fine with it, Mike said. Nothing but a change of clothes and a toothbrush. Are you sure? Yes, Mike said. I'm already wearing my lucky Hawaiian shirt. He smiled. It's the one with the ghost repellent. Olin didn't smile back. He sighed instead, a little round man in a dark cutaway coat and a neatly knotted tie. Very good, Mr. Enslin. Follow me. The hotel manager had seemed tentative in the lobby, almost beaten. In his oak-paneled office, with the pictures of the hotel on the walls, the Dolphin had opened in 1910, Mike might publish without the benefit of reviews in the journals or the big city papers, but he did his research. Olin seemed to gain assurance again. There was a Persian carpet on the floor. Two standing lamps cast a mild yellow light. A desk lamp with a green lozenge-shaped shade stood on the desk next to a humidor. And next to the humidor were Mike Enslin's last three books. Paperback editions, of course. There had been no hardbacks. Mine host has been doing a little research of his own, Mike thought. Mike sat down in front of the desk. He expected Olin to sit behind the desk, but Olin surprised him. He took the chair beside Mike's, crossed his legs, then leaned forward over his tidy little belly to touch the humidor. Cigar, Mr. Enslin? No, thank you. I don't smoke. Olin's eye shifted to the cigarette behind Mike's right ear, parked on a jaunty jut the way an old-time wisecracking reporter might have parked his next smoke just below the press tag stuck in the band of his fedora. The cigarette had become so much a part of him that for a moment Mike honestly didn't know what Olin was looking at. Then he laughed, took it down, looked at it himself, and looked back at Olin. "Haven't had one in 9 years," he said. "Had an older brother who died of lung cancer." I quit after he died. The cigarette behind the ear, he shrugged. Part affectation, part superstition, I guess, like the Hawaiian shirt. Or the cigarettes you sometimes see on people's desks or walls, mounted in a little box with a sign saying, "Break glass in case of emergency." Is 1408 a smoking room, Mr. Olin, just in case nuclear war breaks out? As a matter of fact, it is. Well, Mike said heartily, that's one less worry in the watches of the night. Mr. Olin sighed again, but this sigh didn't have the disconsolate quality of his lobby sigh. Yes, it was the office, Mike reckoned. Olin's office, his special place. Even this afternoon, when Mike had come accompanied by Robertson, the lawyer, Olin had seemed less flustered once they were in here. And why not? Where else could you feel in charge, if not in your special place? Olin's office was a room with good pictures on the walls, a good rug on the floor, and good cigars in the humidor. A lot of managers had no doubt conducted a lot of business in here since 1910. In its own way, it was as New York as the blonde in her black off-the-shoulder dress, her smell of perfume, and her unarticulated promise of sleek New York sex in the small hours of the morning. "You still don't think I can talk you out of this idea of yours, do you?" Olin asked. "I know you can't," Mike said, replacing the cigarette behind his ear. He didn't slick his back with Vitalis or Wildroot cream oil, as those colorful fedora-wearing scribblers of yore had, but he still changed the cigarette every day, just as he changed his underwear. You sweat back there behind your ears. If he examined the cigarette at the end of the day before throwing its unsmoked, deadly length into the toilet, Mike could see the faint yellow-orange residue of that sweat on the thin white paper. It did not increase the temptation to light up. How he had smoked for almost 20 years, 30 butts a day, sometimes 40, was now beyond him. Why he had done it was an even better question. Olin picked up the little stack of paperbacks from the blotter. I sincerely hope you're wrong. Mike ran open the zipper on the side pocket of his overnight bag. He brought out a Sony minicorder. Would you mind if I taped our conversation, Mr. Olin? Olin waved a hand. Mike pushed record, and the little red light came on. The reels began to turn. Olin, meanwhile, was shuffling slowly through the stack of books, reading the titles. As always, when he saw his books in someone else's hands, Mike Enslin felt the oddest mix of emotions. Pride, unease, amusement, defiance, and shame. He had no business feeling ashamed of them. They had kept him nicely over these last 5 years, and he didn't have to share any of the profits with the packager. Book whores was what his agent called them, perhaps partly in envy, because he had come up with a concept himself. Although after the first book had sold so well, only a moron could have missed the concept. What was there to do after Frankenstein but The Bride of Frankenstein? Still, he had gone to Iowa. He had studied with Jane Smiley. He had once been on a panel with Stanley Elkin. He had once aspired, absolutely no one in his current circle of friends and acquaintances had any least inkling of this, to be published as a Yale Younger Poet. And, when the hotel manager began speaking the titles aloud, Mike found himself wishing he hadn't challenged Olin with the recorder. Later, he would listen to Olin's measured tones and imagine he heard contempt in them. He touched the cigarette behind his ear without being aware of it. 10 nights in 10 haunted houses, Olin read. 10 nights in 10 haunted graveyards. 10 nights in 10 haunted castles. He looked up at Mike with a faint smile at the corners of his mouth. Got to Scotland on that one, not to mention the Vienna woods. And all tax-deductible, correct? Hauntings are, after all, your business. Do you have a point? You're sensitive about these, aren't you? Olin asked. Sensitive, yes. Vulnerable, no. If you're hoping to persuade me out of your hotel by critiquing my books... No, not at all. I was curious, that's all. I sent Marcel, he's the concierge on days, out to get them 2 days ago, when you first appeared with your... request. It was a demand, not a request. Still is. You heard, Mr. Robertson, New York State law, not to mention two federal civil rights laws, forbids you to deny me a specific room if I request that specific room and the room is vacant. And 1408 is vacant. 1408 is always vacant these days. But Mr. Olin was not to be diverted from the subject of Mike's last three books, New York Times bestsellers all, just yet. He simply shuffled through them a third time. The mellow lamplight reflected off their shiny covers. There was a lot of purple on the covers. Purple sold scary books better than any other color, Mike had been told. "I didn't get a chance to dip into these until earlier this evening," Olin said. "I've been quite busy. I usually am. The Dolphin is small by New York standards, but we run at 90% occupancy, and usually a problem comes through the front door with every guest."
"Like me."
Olin smiled a little. "I'd say you're a bit of a special problem, Mr. Enslin. You and your Mr. Robertson and all your threats." Mike felt nettled all over again. He had made no threats unless Robertson himself was a threat, and he had been forced to use the lawyer, as a man might be forced to use a crowbar on a rusty lockbox which would no longer accept the key. "The lockbox isn't yours," a voice inside told him, but the laws of the state and the country said differently. The law said that room 1408 in the Hotel Dolphin was his if he wanted it, and as long as no one else had it first. He became aware that Olin was watching him, still with that faint smile, as if he had been following Mike's interior dialogue almost word for word. It was an uncomfortable feeling, and Mike was finding this an unexpectedly uncomfortable meeting. It felt as if he had been on the defensive ever since he'd taken out the mini-quarter, which was usually intimidating, and turned it on. "If any of this has a point, Mr. Olin, I'm afraid I lost sight of it a turn or two back, and I've had a long day. If our wrangle over room 1408 is really over, I'd like to go on upstairs and—" "I read one of your, what would you call them? Essays? Tales?"
"Bill payers" was what Mike called them, but he didn't intend to say that with the tape running, not even though it was his tape.
"Story," Olin decided. "I read one story from each book, the one about the Rilsby House in Kansas from your haunted house book."
"Ah, yes. The Axe Murders."
The fellow who had chopped up all six members of the Eugene Rilsby family had never been caught. "Exactly so. And the one about the night you spent camped out on the graves of the lovers in Alaska who committed suicide. The ones people keep claiming to see around Sitka. And the account of your night in Gotsby Castle. That was actually quite amusing. I was surprised." Mike's ear was carefully tuned to catch the undernotes of contempt in even the blandest comments about his 10 Nights books, and he had no doubt that he sometimes heard contempt that wasn't there. Few creatures on earth are so paranoid as the writer who believes, deep in his heart, that he is slumming, Mike had discovered. But he didn't believe there was any contempt here.
"Thank you," he said, "I guess."
He glanced down at his mini-quarter. Usually its little red eye seemed to be watching the other guy, daring him to say the wrong thing. This evening, it seemed to be looking at Mike himself. "Oh, yes, I meant it as a compliment." Olin tapped the books. "I expect to finish these, but for the writing. It's the writing I like. I was surprised to find myself laughing at your quite unsupernatural adventures in Gotsby Castle, and I was surprised to find you as good as you are. As subtle as you are, I expected more hack and slash." Mike steeled himself for what would almost certainly come next, Olin's variation of "What's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this?" Olin, the urbane hotelier, host to blonde women who wore black dresses out into the night, hirer of weedy retiring men who wore tuxes and tinkled old standards like night and day in the hotel bar. Olin, who probably read Proust on his nights off. "But they are disturbing, too, these books. If I hadn't looked at them, I don't think I would have bothered waiting for you this evening. Once I saw that lawyer with his briefcase, I knew you meant to stay in that goddamned room, and that nothing I could say was apt to dissuade you.
but the books. Mike reached out and snapped off the minicorder. That little red staring eye was starting to give him the willies. Do you want to know why I'm bottom feeding? Is that it? I assume you do it for the money, Olin said mildly. And you're feeding a long way from the bottom, at least in my estimation. Although it's interesting that you would jump so nimbly to such a conclusion. Mike felt warmth rising in his cheeks. No, this wasn't going the way he had expected at all. He had never snapped his recorder off in the middle of a conversation. But Olin wasn't what he had seen. I was led astray by his hands, Mike thought. Those pudgy little hotel manager's hands with their neat white crescents of manicured nail. What concerned me, what frightened me, is that I found myself reading the work of an intelligent, talented man who doesn't believe one single thing he has written. That wasn't exactly true, Mike thought. He had written perhaps 24 stories he believed in, had actually published a few. He'd written reams of poetry he believed in during his first 18 months in New York, when he had starved on the payroll of the Village Voice. But did he believe that the headless ghost of Eugene Rilsby walked his deserted Kansas farmhouse by moonlight? No. He had spent the night in that farmhouse, camped out on the dirty linoleum hills of the kitchen floor, and had seen nothing scarier than 2 mice trundling along the baseboard. He had spent a hot summer night in the ruins of the Transylvanian castle, where Vlad Tepish supposedly still held court. The only vampires to actually show up had been European mosquitoes. During his night camped out by the grave of serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer, a white, blood-streaked figure waving a knife had come at him out of the 2 o'clock darkness. But the giggles of the apparition's friends had given him away, and Mike Enslin hadn't been terribly impressed anyway. He knew a teenage ghost waving a rubber knife when he saw one. But he had no intention of telling any of this to Olin. He couldn't afford... Except he could. The minicorder, a mistake from the get-go, he now understood, was stowed away again, and this meeting was about as off the record as you could get. Also, he had come to admire Olin in a weird way, and when you admired a man, you wanted to tell him the truth. No, he said. I don't believe in ghoulies and ghosties and long-leggedy beasties. I think it's good there are no such things because I don't believe there's any good lord that can protect us from them either. That's what I believe, but I've kept an open mind from the very start. I may never win the Pulitzer Prize for investigating the barking ghost in Mount Hope Cemetery, but I would have written fairly about him if he had shown up. Olin said something, only a single word, but too low for Mike to make out. I beg pardon? I said no. Olin looked at him almost apologetically. Mike sighed. Olin thought he was a liar. When you got to that point, the only choices were to put up your dukes or disengage totally from the discussion. Why don't we leave this for another day, Mr. Olin? I'll just go on upstairs and brush my teeth. Perhaps I'll see Kevin O'Malley materialize behind me in the bathroom mirror. Mike started to get out of his chair, and Olin put out one of his pudgy, carefully manicured hands to stop him. I'm not calling you a liar, he said, but Mr. Enslin, you don't believe. Ghosts rarely appear to those who don't believe in them, and when they do, they are rarely seen. Why, Eugene Rilsby could have bowled his severed head all the way down the front hall of his home, and you wouldn't have heard a thing. Mike stood up, then bent to grab his overnight case. If that's so, I won't have anything to worry about in room 1408, will I? But you will, Olin said. You will. Because there are no ghosts in room 1408 and never have been. There's something in there. I felt it myself, but it's not a spirit presence. In an abandoned house or an old castle keep, your unbelief may serve you as protection. In room 1408, it will only render you more vulnerable. Don't do it, Mr. Enslin. That's why I waited for you tonight, to ask you, beg you, not to do it. Of all the people on earth who don't belong in that room, the man who wrote those cheerful, exploitative, true ghost books leads the list. Mike heard this and didn't hear it at the same time. "And you turned off your tape recorder," he was raving. "He embarrasses me into turning off my tape recorder, and then he turns into Boris Karloff hosting the All-Star Spook Weekend. Fuck it. I'll quote him anyway. If he doesn't like it, let him sue me." All at once he was burning to get upstairs, not just so he could start getting his long night in a corner hotel room over with, but because he wanted to transcribe what Olin had just said while it was still fresh in his mind. "Have a drink, Mr. Enslin." "No, I really..." Mr. Olin reached into his coat pocket and brought out a key on a long brass paddle. The brass looked old and scratched and tarnished. Embossed on it were the numbers 1408. "Please," Olin said. "Humor me. You give me 10 more minutes of your time, long enough to consume a short scotch, and I'll hand you this key. I would give almost anything to be able to change your mind, but I like to think I can recognize the inevitable when I see it." "You still use actual keys here?" Mike asked. "That's sort of a nice touch. Antique-y." "The Dolphin went to a mag card system in 1979, Mr. Enslin, the year I took the job as manager. 1408 is the only room in the house that still opens with a key. There was no need to put a mag card lock on its door, because there's never anyone inside. The room was last occupied by a paying guest in 1978. "You're shitting me." Mike sat down again and unlimbered his mini-corder again. He pushed the record button and said, "House Manager Olin claims 1408 not rented to a paying guest in over 20 years. It is just as well that 1408 has never needed a mag card lock on its door, because I am completely positive the device wouldn't work. Digital wristwatches don't work in room 1408. Sometimes they run backwards, sometimes they simply go out, but you can't tell time with one. Not in room 1408, you can't. The same is true of pocket calculators and cell phones. If you're wearing a beeper, Mr. Enslin, I advise you to turn it off, because once you're in room 1408, it will start beeping at will." He paused. "And turning it off isn't guaranteed to work either. It may turn itself back on. The only sure cure is to pull the batteries." He pushed the stop button on the minicorder without examining the buttons. Mike supposed he used a similar model for dictating memos. "Actually, Mr. Enslin, the only sure cure is to stay the hell out of that room." "I can't do that," Mike said, taking his minicorder back and stowing it once more. "But I think I can take time for that drink." While Olin poured at the fumed oak bar beneath an oil painting of Fifth Avenue at the turn of the century, Mike asked him how, if the room had been continuously unoccupied since 1978, Olin knew that high-tech gadgets didn't work inside. "I didn't intend to give you the impression that no one had set foot through the door since 1978, Olin replied. "For one thing, there are maids in once a month to give the place a light turn. That means..." Mike, who had been working on 10 haunted hotel rooms for about 4 months at that point, said, "I know what it means. A light turn in an unoccupied room would include opening the windows to change the air, dusting, enough tidy bowl in the can to turn the water briefly blue, a change of towels. Probably not the bed linen, not on a light turn. He wondered if he should have brought his sleeping bag. Crossing the Persian from the bar with their drinks in his hands, Olin seemed to read Mike's thought on his face. "The sheets were changed this very afternoon, Mr. Enslin." "Why don't you drop that? Call me Mike." "I don't think I'd be comfortable with that," Olin said, handing Mike his drink. "Here's to you." "And you." Mike lifted his glass, meaning to clink it against Olin's, but Olin pulled his back. "No, to you, Mr. Enslin, I insist. Tonight we should both drink to you. You'll need it." Mike sighed, clinked the rim of his glass against the rim of Olin's, and said, "To me. You would have been right at home in a horror movie, Mr. Olin. You could have played the gloomy old butler who tries to warn the young married couple away from Castle Doom." Olin sat down. It's a part I haven't had to play often, thank God. Room 1408 isn't listed on any of the websites dealing with paranormal locations or psychic hotspots.
That'll change after my book, Mike thought, sipping his drink.
And there are no ghost tours with stops at the Hotel Dolphin, although they do tour through the Sherry Netherland, the Plaza, and the Park Lane. We have kept 1408 as quiet as possible, although, of course, the history has always been there for a researcher who is both lucky and tenacious. Mike allowed himself a small smile.
Veronique changed the sheets, Olin said. I accompanied her.
You should feel flattered, Mr. Enslin. It's almost like having your knight's linen put on by royalty. Veronique and her sister came to the Dolphin as chambermaids in 1971 or 72. V, as we call her, is the Hotel Dolphin's longest-running employee, with at least 6 years' seniority over me. She has since risen to head housekeeper. I'd guess she hadn't changed a sheet in 6 years before today, but she used to do all the turns in 1408. She and her sister, until about 1992. Veronique and Celeste were twins, and the bond between them seemed to make them, how shall I put it? Not immune to 1408, but it's equal, at least for the short periods of time needed to give the room a light turn.
You're not going to tell me this Veronique's sister died in the room, are you?
No, not at all, Olin said. She left service here around 1988, suffering from ill health. But I don't rule out the idea that 1408 may have played a part in her worsening mental and physical condition.
We seem to have built a rapport here, Mr. Olin. I hope I don't snap it by telling you I find that ridiculous.
Olin laughed. So hard-headed for a student of the airy world.
I owe it to my readers, Mike said blandly.
I suppose I simply could have left 1408 as it is anyway during most of its days and nights, the hotel manager mused. Door locked, lights off, shades drawn to keep the sun from fading the carpet, coverlet pulled up, doorknob breakfast menu on the bed. But I can't bear to think of the air getting stuffy and old, like the air in an attic. Can't bear to think of the dust piling up until it's thick and fluffy. What does that make me, persnickety or downright obsessive?
It makes you a hotel manager.
I suppose. In any case, V and C turned that room, very quick, just in and out, until C retired and V got her first big promotion. After that, I got other maids to do it in pairs, always picking ones who got on well with each other.
Hoping for that bond to withstand the bogeys?
Hoping for that bond, yes. And you can make fun of the room 1408 bogeys as much as you want, Mr. Enslin, but you'll feel them almost at once, of that I'm confident. Whatever there is in that room, it's not shy. On many occasions, all that I could manage, I went with the maids to supervise them. He paused, then added almost reluctantly, to pull them out, I suppose, if anything really awful started to happen. Nothing ever did. There were several who had weeping fits, one who had a laughing fit. I don't know why someone laughing out of control should be more frightening than someone sobbing, but it is. And a number who fainted. Nothing too terrible, however. I had time enough over the years to make a few primitive experiments, beepers and cell phones and such, but nothing too terrible. Thank God. He paused again, then added in a queer, flat tone, one of them went blind.
What?
She went blind. Rami Van Gelder, that was. She was dusting the top of the television, and all at once she began to scream. I asked her what was wrong. She dropped her dust rag and put her hands over her eyes and screamed that she was blind, but that she could see the most awful colors. They went away almost as soon as I got her out through the door, and by the time I got her down the hallway to the elevator, her sight had begun to come back.
You're telling me all this just to scare me, Mr. Olin, aren't you? To scare me off?
Indeed, I am not. You know the history of the room, beginning with the suicide of its first occupant.
Mike did.
Kevin O'Malley, a sewing machine salesman, had taken his life on October 13, 1910, a leaper who had left a wife and seven children behind. 5 men and 1 woman have jumped from that room's single window, Mr. Enslin. Three women and one man have overdosed with pills in that room. Two found in bed, two found in the bathroom, one in the tub and one sitting slumped on the toilet. A man hanged himself in the closet in 1970. Henry Storkin, Mike said. That one was probably accidental, erotic asphyxia. Perhaps. There was also Randolph Hyde, who slit his wrists and then cut off his genitals for good measure while he was bleeding to death. That one wasn't erotic asphyxia. The point is, Mr. Enslin, that if you can't be swayed from your intention by a record of 12 suicides in 68 years, I doubt if the gasps and fibrillations of a few chambermaids will stop you. Gasps and fibrillations, that's nice, Mike thought, and wondered if he could steal it for the book. Few of the pairs who have turned 1408 over the years care to go back more than a few times, Olin said, and finished his drink in a tidy little gulp. Except for the French twins. V and C, that's true, Olin nodded. Mike didn't care much about the maids and their, what had Olin called them, their gasps and fibrillations. He did feel mildly rankled by Olin's enumeration of the suicides, as if Mike was so thick he had missed not the fact of them, but their import. Except, really, there was no import. Both Abraham Lincoln and John Kennedy had vice presidents named Johnson. The names Lincoln and Kennedy had seven letters. Both Lincoln and Kennedy had been elected in years ending in 60. What did all these coincidences prove? Not a damn thing. The suicides will make a wonderful segment for my book, Mike said, but since the tape recorder is off, I can tell you they amount to what a statistician resource of mine calls the cluster effect. Charles Dickens called it the potato effect, Olin said. I beg your pardon? When Jacob Marley's ghost first speaks to Scrooge, Scrooge tells him he could be nothing but a blob of mustard or a bit of underdone potato. Is that supposed to be funny? Mike asked a trifle coldly. Nothing about this strikes me as funny, Mr. Enslin. Nothing at all. Listen very closely, please. V's sister, Celeste, died of a heart attack. At that point, she was suffering mid-stage Alzheimer's, a disease which struck her very early in life. Yet her sister is fine and well, according to what you said earlier. An American success story, in fact. As you are yourself, Mr. Olin, from the look of you. Yet you've been in and out of room 1408 how many times? 100? 200? For very short periods of time, Olin said. It's perhaps like entering a room filled with poison gas. If one holds one's breath, one may be all right. I see you don't like that comparison. You no doubt find it overwrought, perhaps ridiculous. Yet I believe it's a good one. He steepled his fingers beneath his chin. It's also possible that some people react more quickly and more violently to whatever lives in that room, just as some people who go scuba diving are more prone to the bends than others. Over the Dolphin's near century of operation, the hotel staff has grown ever more aware that 1408 is a poisoned room. It has become part of the house history, Mr. Enslin. No one talks about it, just as no one mentions the fact that here, as in most hotels, the 14th floor is actually the 13th, but they know it. If all the facts and records pertaining to that room were available, they would tell an amazing story, one more uncomfortable than your readers might enjoy. I should guess, for example, that every hotel in New York has had its suicides, but I would be willing to wager my life that only in the Dolphin have there been a dozen of them in a single room. And leaving Celeste Romandeau aside, what about the natural deaths in 1408? The so-called natural deaths? How many have there been? The idea of so-called natural deaths in 1408 had never occurred to him. 30, Olin replied. 30 at least. 30 that I know of. You're lying. The words were out of his mouth before he could call them back. No, Mr. Enslin, I assure you I'm not. Did you really think that we keep that room empty just out of some vapid old wives' superstition or ridiculous New York tradition? The idea maybe that every fine old hotel should have at least one unquiet spirit clanking around in the suite of invisible chains? Mike Enslin realized that just such an idea, not articulated, but there, just the same, had indeed been hanging around his new Ten Nights book. To hear Olin scoff at it in the irritated tones of a scientist scoffing at a Bruja-waving native did nothing to soothe his chagrin. We have our superstitions and traditions in the hotel trade, but we don't let them get in the way, Mr. Ensland. There's an old saying in the Midwest, where I broke into the business, there are no drafty rooms when the cattlemen are in town. If we have empties, we fill them. The only exception to that rule I have ever made, and the only talk like this I have ever had, is on account of room 1408, a room on the 13th floor whose very numerals add up to 13. Olin looked levelly at Mike Ensland. It is a room not only of suicides, but of strokes and heart attacks and epileptic seizures. One man who stayed in that room, this was in 1973, apparently drowned in a bowl of soup. You would undoubtedly call that ridiculous, but I spoke to the man who was head of hotel security at that time, and he saw the death certificate. The power of whatever inhabits the room seems to be less around midday, which is when the room turns always occur, and yet I know of several maids who have turned that room who now suffer from heart problems, emphysema, diabetes. There was a heating problem on that floor 3 years ago, and Mr. Neal, the head maintenance engineer at that time, had to go in several of the rooms to check the heating units. 1408 was one of them. He seemed fine then, both in the room and later on, but he died the following afternoon of a massive cerebral hemorrhage.
Coincidence, Mike said.
Yet he could not deny that Olin was good. Had the man been a camp counselor, he would have scared 90% of the kiddies back home after the first round of campfire ghost stories. Coincidence. Olin repeated it softly, not quite contemptuously. He held out the old-fashioned key on its old-fashioned brass paddle. How is your own heart, Mr. Ensland, not to mention your blood pressure and psychological condition? Mike found it took an actual, conscious effort to lift his hand, but once he got it moving, it was fine. It rose to the key without even the minutest trembling of the fingertips, so far as he could see.
All fine, he said, grasping the worn brass paddle. Besides, I'm wearing my lucky Hawaiian shirt.
Olin insisted on accompanying Mike to the 14th floor in the elevator, and Mike did not demur. He was interested to see that once they were out of the manager's office and walking down the hall which led to the elevators, the man reverted to his less consequential self. He became once again poor Mr. Olin, the flunky who had fallen into the writer's clutches. A man in a tux, Mike guessed he was either the restaurant manager or the maitre d', stopped them, offered Olin a thin sheaf of papers, and murmured to him in French. Olin murmured back, nodding, and quickly scribbled his signature on the sheets. The fellow in the bar was now playing Sunday in New York. From this distance, it had an echoey sound, like music heard in a dream. The man in the tuxedo said, "Merci bien," and went on his way. Mike and the hotel manager went on theirs. Olin again asked if he could carry Mike's little valise, and Mike again refused. In the elevator, Mike found his eyes drawn to the neat triple row of buttons. Everything was where it should have been. There were no gaps. And yet, if you looked more closely, you saw that there was. The button marked 12 was followed by one marked 14. As if, Mike thought, they could make the number non-existent by omitting it from the control panel of an elevator. Foolishness. And yet, Olin was right. It was done all over the world. As the car rose, Mike said, "I'm curious about something. Why didn't you simply create a fictional resident for room 1408, if it scares you as badly as you say it does? For that matter, Mr. Olin, why not declare it as your own residence?"
"I suppose I was afraid I would be accused of fraud, if not by the people responsible for enforcing state and federal civil rights statutes. Hotel people feel about civil rights laws as many of your readers probably feel about clanking chains in the night. Then by my bosses, if they got wind of it. I couldn't persuade you to stay out of 1408.
I doubt if I would have had much more luck in convincing the Stanley Corporation's board of directors that I took a perfectly good room off the market because I was afraid the spooks caused the occasional traveling salesman to jump out the window and splatter himself all over 61st Street. Mike found this the most disturbing thing Olin had said yet. "Because he's not trying to convince me anymore," he thought. "Whatever salesmanship powers he had in his office, and maybe it's some vibe that comes up from the Persian rug, he loses it out here. Competency, yes, you could see that when he was signing the maitre d's chits, but not salesmanship, not personal magnetism, not out here. But he believes it. He believes it all." Above the door, the illuminated 12 went out, and the 14 came on. The elevator stopped. The door slid open to reveal a perfectly ordinary hotel corridor with a red and gold carpet, most definitely not a Persian, and electric fixtures that looked like 19th century gas lights. "Here we are," Olin said. "Your floor. You'll pardon me if I leave you here. 1408 is to your left, at the end of the hall. Unless I absolutely have to, I don't go any closer than this." Mike Ensland stepped out of the elevator on legs that seemed heavier than they should have. He turned back to Olin, a pudgy little man in a black coat and a carefully knotted wine-colored tie. Olin's carefully manicured hands were clasped behind him now, and Mike saw that the little man's face was as pale as cream. On his high, lineless forehead, drops of perspiration stood out. "There's a telephone in the room, of course," Olin said. "You could try it, if you find yourself in trouble, but I doubt if it will work. Not if the room doesn't want it to." Mike thought of a light reply, something about how that would save him a room service charge, at least. But all at once his tongue seemed as heavy as his legs. It just lay there on the floor of his mouth. Olin brought one hand out from behind his back, and Mike saw it was trembling. "Mr. Ensland," he said. "Mike, don't do this. For God's sake." Before he could finish,